And why shouldn't you be? Her mother said, holding her tight. That louse walks out on you? You're supporting yourself and Marcy going to school? You've got every right to be touchy. We're so proud of you, Georgia. It takes such courage to do what you're doing.
In the living room, Marcy began shrieking. What now? Georgia wondered. When she got to the living room archway, she saw her father trying to persuade Marcy to play with a doll.
Look here, Pete said. Dolly cries when you tilt her this way, giggles when you tilt her that way. I don't want to play with the dumb doll,
Marcy pouted. She was holding the make-believe plastic and rubber hypodermic syringe from the Little Miss Doctor kit, and that unsettling intensity and urgency had taken possession of her again.
I want to give you another shot.
But, honey, Pete said, you've already given me 20 shots.
I got to practice,
Marcy said.
I'll never grow up to be my own doctor if I don't start practicing now.
Pete looked at Georgia with exasperation. Mary said,
what is it with this Little Miss Doctor thing? I wish I knew, Georgia said.
Marcy grimaced as she pushed the plunger of the fake hypodermic. Perspiration glistened on her brow.
I wish I knew, Georgia repeated uneasily.
Boston, Massachusetts. It was the worst Christmas of Ginger Weiss's life. Although Jewish, her beloved father had always celebrated Christmas in a secular spirit, because he liked the harmony and goodwill that the holiday promoted, and after his death, Ginger had continued to regard December 25th as a special day, a time of joy. Until today, Christmas had never depressed her. George and Rita did all they could to make Ginger feel a part of their celebration, but she was acutely aware that she was an outsider. The Hannabys' three sons had brought their families to Baywatch for several days, and the huge house was filled with the silvery laughter of children. Everyone made an effort to include Ginger in all the Hannaby traditions, from popcorn stringing to neighborhood caroling. Christmas morning, she was there to watch the children attack the mountain of gifts, and following the example of the other adults, she crawled around on the floor with the kids, helping them assemble and play with their new toys. For a couple of hours, her despair abated, and she was assimilated by the Hannaby family in spite of herself. However, at lunch, rich with holiday delicacies yet essentially a light meal, just a hint of the extravagant dinner feast to come that evening, Ginger felt out of place again. Much conversation involved reminiscences of previous holidays of which she'd not been a part. After lunch, she pleaded a headache and escaped to her room. The splendid view of the bay calmed her, but couldn't arrest her spiral into depression. She desperately hoped Pablo Jackson would call tomorrow and say that he had studied the problem of memory blocks and was ready to hypnotize her again. Ginger's visit to Pablo had distressed George and Rita less than she had expected. They were upset that she had gone out alone, risking an amnesic seizure with no friend to help her, and they made her promise she would allow either Rita or one of the servants to drive her to and from Pablo's apartment in the future, but they did not attempt to argue against the unconventional treatment she had sought from the magician. The Bayview's capacity to calm Ginger was limited. She turned from the window, got up, and went to the bed, where she was surprised to find two books on the nightstand. One was a fantasy by Tim Powers, an author she had read before, the other a copy of something called Twilight in Babylon, and she had no idea where they had come from. There were half a dozen other books in the room, borrowed from the library downstairs, for during the past few weeks she had little to do but read. But this was the first time she'd seen Powers' book and Twilight in Babylon. The former, a tale of time-traveling trolls fighting their own secret war against British goblins during the American Revolution, looked delightful, the type of exotic story that her father had enjoyed. A slip of paper laid loosely in the front identified it as a review copy. Rita had a friend who was a reviewer for the Globe,
and who sometimes passed along intriguing books before they were available in the stores. Evidently, these had come within the last day or two, and Rita, aware of Ginger's tastes in fiction, had put them in her room. She set the Powers book aside for later delectation, and she took a closer look at Twilight in Babylon. She had never heard of the author, Dominic Corvaces, but the brief summary of the story was intriguing, and when she had read the first page, she was hooked. However, before continuing, she moved from the bed to one of the comfortable chairs and only then glanced at the author's photograph on the back of the jacket. Her breath caught in her throat. Fear filled her. For a moment she thought the photograph was going to be the kicker that knocked her into another fugue. She tried to fling the book aside but could not, tried to stand up but could not. She drew deep breaths, closed her eyes, and waited for her pulse rate to sink toward normal. When she opened her eyes and looked at the author's photograph again, it still disturbed her, though not as badly as it had at first. She knew that she had seen this man before, had met him somewhere, and not in the best of circumstances, though she could not remember where or when. His brief biography on the jacket flap informed her that he had lived in Portland, Oregon, and now resided in Laguna Beach, California. As she had never been in either of those places, she could not imagine when their paths might have crossed. Dominic Corvaces, about 35, was a striking man who reminded Ginger of Anthony Perkins when that actor had been younger. His looks were compelling enough that she could not imagine having forgotten where she had met him. Her instant reaction to the photo was strange, and some might have dismissed it as a meaningless fillip of an overwrought mind. But during the past 2 months she had learned to respect strange developments and to look for meaning in them, no matter how meaningless they seemed. She stared at Corvaces's photograph, hoping to nudge her memory. Finally, with an almost clairvoyant sense that Twilight in Babylon would somehow change her life, she opened it and began to read. Chicago, Illinois. From University Hospital, Father Stefan Vikazic drove across town to the laboratory operated by the Scientific Investigation Division of the Chicago Police Department. Though it was Christmas Day, municipal workers were still cleaning last night's snowfall from the streets. Only a couple of men were on duty at the police lab, which was located in an aging government building, and the old rooms had the deserted feeling of an elaborate Egyptian tomb buried far beneath desert sands. Footsteps echoed resoundingly back and forth between the tile floors and the high ceilings. Ordinarily, the lab did not share its information with anyone from outside the police and judicial systems, but half the police officers in Chicago were Catholics, which meant that Father Vikazic had more than a few friends on the force. Stefan had importuned some of those friends to make petitions in his name and to pave the way for him at the SID. He was greeted by Dr. Murphy Ames, a paunchy man with a perfectly bald head and walrus mustache. They had spoken on the telephone earlier, before Stefan left the rectory for University Hospital, and now Murphy Ames was ready for him. They settled on two stools at a laboratory bench. A tall, opaque window loomed in front of them, decorated with dark streaks of pigeon dung. On the marble top of the bench, Ames had laid out a file folder and several other items.
I must say, Father, I'd never compromise case information like this if there were any possibility of a trial arising from the shootout at that sandwich shop. But, I suppose as both perpetrators are dead, there's no one to be put on trial.
I appreciate that, Dr. Ames. I really do. And I'm grateful for the time and energy you've expended on my behalf. Curiosity ruled Murphy Ames's face. He said,
I don't really understand the reason for your interest in the case.
I'm not entirely sure of it myself, Stefan said cryptically. He had not revealed his purpose to the higher authorities who had made him welcome at the lab, and he did not intend to enlighten Ames either. For one thing, if he told them what was on his mind, they would think he was dotty and would be less inclined to cooperate with him.
Well,
Ames said, miffed at not being taken into Stefan's confidence.
You asked about the bullets?
He opened a manila envelope of the type that ties shut with a string, and he emptied its contents into his palm, two gray lumps of lead.
The surgeon removed these from Winton Toke. You said you were particularly interested in them?
I certainly am, Stefan said, taking them in his own hand when Ames offered them. You've weighed these, I suppose? I understand that standard procedure, and they weigh what 38 slugs should.
If you mean did they fragment on impact, they did not. They're so misshapen they must have impacted bone, so it's surprising they didn't fragment a little, or a lot. But in fact, they're both intact.
Actually, Father Vikazic said, staring at the slugs in his hand, I meant, were they underweight for 38s? Malformed ammunition, factory mistakes, or were they the right size?
Both the right size, no doubt of that.
Big enough to do plenty of damage. Terrible damage, Father Vikazic said thoughtfully. The gun? From a larger envelope, Ames produced the revolver with which Winton Toke was shot.
A snub-nosed Smith & Wesson 38 Chief Special.
You've examined it? Test-fired it?
Yes, standard procedure.
No indication that anything's wrong with it? Specifically, is the bore poorly machined, or is there some other anomaly that had resulted in the bullet leaving the muzzle at a much slower velocity than it should?
That's a peculiar question, Father. The answer is no. It's a fine Chief's Special, up to the usual high standards of Smith & Wesson.
Putting the two expended bullets back into the small envelope from which he had seen Ames take them, Father Vikazic said, What about the cartridges these bullets came from? Is there any chance they were filled with too little powder that they carried an inadequate charge? The SID man blinked.
I gather one thing you're trying to find out is why two 38s in the chest didn't do more damage.
Stefan Vikazic nodded, but offered no elaboration. Were there any unexpended cartridges in the revolver?
A couple, plus spare ammunition in one of the gunman's jacket pockets, another dozen.
Did you cut open any of the unexpended shells to see if maybe they carried an inadequate charge?
No reason to, Murphy Ames said.
Would it be possible for you to check one of them now?
Possible. But why, Father, what in the world is this all about?
Stefan sighed. I know this is an imposition, Dr. Ames, and it behooves me to repay your kindness with an explanation, but I can't. Not yet. Priests, like physicians and attorneys, must sometimes respect confidences, keep secrets. But if I'm ever at liberty to reveal what lies behind my curiosity, you'll be the first to know. Ames stared, and Stefan met his eyes forthrightly. Finally, the SID man opened another envelope. This contained the unexpended cartridges from the dead gunman's 38 Chief's Special.
Wait here.
In 20 minutes, Ames returned with a white enamel lab tray in which were two dissected 38 Special cartridges. Using a pencil as a pointer, he commented on the disassembled elements.
This is the case head in which the primer assembly is seated. The firing pin strikes here. This opening on the other side of the case head is the flash hole that leads from the primer packet to the powder compartment. There's no problem with this. No manufacturing errors. At the other end of the cartridge, you've got a lead semi-wad cutter bullet with a copper gas check crimped onto its base to retard bore letting. The tiny cannelures around the bullet are packed with grease to ease its passage through the barrel. Nothing out of order here, either. And in between the case head and the bullet is the powder compartment, or it's sometimes called the combustion chamber, out of which I've taken this small pile of gray flaky material. This is nitrocellulose, a highly combustible material. It's ignited by the spark that comes through the flash hole from the primer. It explodes, ejecting the bullet from the cartridge.
As you can see, there's enough nitrile cellulose to fill the powder chamber. Just to be sure, I open another round.
Ames pointed the pencil at the second disassembled cartridge.
There was nothing wrong with this either. The gunman was using well-made, reliable Remington ammunition. Officer Toke was just a lucky man, Father, a very lucky man.
New York, New York. Jack Twist spent Christmas in the sanitarium room with Jenny, his wife of 13 years. Being with her on holidays was especially grim. But being anywhere else, leaving her alone, would have been grimmer. Although Jenny had spent almost two-thirds of their marriage in a coma, the years of lost communion had not diminished Jack's love for her. More than 8 years had passed since she had smiled at him, or spoken his name, or been able to return his kisses, but in his heart, at least, time was stopped, and she was still the beautiful Jenny Mae Alexander, a fresh-faced young bride. Incarcerated in that Central American prison, he had been sustained by the knowledge that Jenny waited at home for him, missed him, worried about him, and prayed each night for his safe return. Throughout his ordeal of torture and periodic starvation, he had clung to the hope that he would one day feel Jenny's arms around him and hear her marvelous laugh. That hope had kept him alive and sane. Of the four captured Rangers, only Jack and his buddy Oscar Weston survived and came home, though their escape was a near thing. They had waited almost a year to be rescued, confident that their country would not leave them to rot. Sometimes they debated whether they would be freed by commandos or through diplomatic channels. After 11 months, they still believed their countrymen would bail them out, but they no longer dared to wait. They had lost weight and were dangerously thin, undernourished. They had also suffered unknown tropical fevers without treatment, which had further debilitated them. Their only opportunity for escape was during one of their regular visits to the People's Center for Justice. Every 4 weeks, Jack and Oscar had been taken from their cells and driven to the People's Center, a clean, well-lighted, unwalled, unbarred institution in the heart of the capital, a model prison meant to impress foreign journalists with the current regime's humanitarianism. There they were given showers, deloused, put in clean clothes, handcuffed to prevent gesturing, and seated before videotape cameras to be politely questioned. Usually, they answered questions with obscenities or wisecracks. Their answers did not matter because the tape was edited, and answers they had never made were dubbed in by linguists who could speak unaccented English. Once the propaganda film had been made, they were interviewed over closed-circuit television by foreign reporters gathered in another room. The camera never provided close-ups of them, and their answers were not heard by those who asked the questions. Instead, once again, unseen intelligence men, stationed at another microphone outside the camera's range, answered for them. At the start of their 11th month in captivity, Jack and Oscar began making plans to escape the next time they were transported to that far less secure, less heavily guarded propaganda facility. The once formidable strength of their young bodies had been leached away, and their only weapons were shivs and needles made of rat bones, which they had painstakingly shaped and sharpened by rubbing them against the stone walls of the cells. Wickedly sharp, those instruments nevertheless made pathetic weapons. Yet Jack and Oscar hoped to triumph over gun-toting guards. Surprisingly, they did triumph. Once inside the People's Center, they were remanded into the custody of a single guard who escorted them to the showers on the second floor. The guard kept his gun holstered, probably because the facility was a detention center inside the larger detention center of the capital city itself. The guard was certain Jack and Oscar were demoralized, weak and unarmed. So he was surprised when they suddenly turned on him and with shocking savagery stabbed him with the bone shivs they had concealed in their clothes. Pierced twice in the throat, his right eye skewered,
he succumbed without producing a scream that might have drawn other police or soldiers. Before their break was discovered, Jack and Oscar confiscated the dead guard's handgun and ammunition, then made bold use of the hallways, risking notice, alarm, and capture. But it was, after all, a minimum security re-education center, and they were able to make their way to a stairwell and down to a dimly lighted basement, where they progressed swiftly and stealthily through a series of musty storage rooms. At the end of the building, they found the loading docks and a way out. 7 or 8 large boxes had just been offloaded from a delivery truck, which was backed up to the nearest of the 2 big bays, and the driver was engaged in an argument with another man. Both of them were shaking clipboards at each other. Those two were the only men in sight, and as they turned and headed toward a glass-enclosed office, Jack and Oscar raced silently to the recently unloaded boxes, and from there into the back of the delivery truck, where they made a nest for themselves behind the as-yet-undelivered packages. In a few minutes, the driver returned, cursing, slammed the truck's cargo bay door, and drove away into the city before the alarm sounded. 10 minutes, and many blocks from the People's Center, the truck stopped. The driver unbolted the rear doors, took out a single package without realizing Jack and Oscar were inches from him behind a wall of boxes, and went into the building before which he had parked. Extricating themselves from their burrow, Jack and Oscar fled. Within a few blocks, they found themselves in a district of muddy streets and dilapidated shanties, where the poverty-stricken residents were no fonder of the new tyrants than they had been of the old, and were willing to hide 2 Yankees on the lam. After nightfall, supplied with what little food the slum dwellers could spare, they departed for the outskirts. When they came to open farmland, they broke into a barn and stole a sharp sickle, several withered apples, a leather blacksmith's apron, and some burlap bags which could be used to fashion makeshift shoes when their shabby prison issue eventually fell apart, and a horse. Before dawn, they had reached the edge of the true jungle, where they abandoned the horse and set out on foot once more. Weak, poorly provisioned, armed only with the sickle and the gun they had taken off the guard, without a compass and therefore required to plot a course by the sun and the stars, they headed north through the tropical forests toward the border, 80 miles away. Throughout that nightmare journey, Jack had one vital aid to survival. Jenny. He thought of her, dreamed of her, longed for her. And 7 days later, when he and Oscar reached friendly territory, Jack knew that he had made it as much because of Jenny as because of his ranger training. At that point, he thought the worst was behind him. He was wrong. Now, sitting beside his wife's bed with Christmas music on the tape deck, Jack Twist was suddenly overcome with grief. Christmas was a bad time, because he could not help but remember how dreams of her had sustained him through his Christmas in prison, when in fact she had already been in a coma and lost to him. Happy holidays. Chicago, Illinois. As Father Stefan Vikazic moved through the halls and wards of St. Joseph's Hospital for Children, his spirit soared. That was no small thing, for he was already in a buoyant and elevated state. The hospital was crowded with visitors, and Christmas music issued from the public address system. Mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, grandparents, other relatives, and friends of the young patients were on hand with gifts, goodies, and good wishes. And there was more laughter in that usually grim place than one might ordinarily hear echoing through its chambers in an entire month. Even most of the seriously afflicted patients were smiling broadly and talking animatedly, their suffering forgotten for the time being. Nowhere in the hospital was there more hope or laughter than among those people gathered around the bed of 10-year-old Emmeline Hallberg. When Father Vikazic introduced himself, he was greeted warmly by Emmy Hallberg's parents, 2 sisters, grandparents, 1 aunt and 1 uncle, who assumed he was one of the hospital's chaplains. Because of what he had learned from Brendan Cronin yesterday, Stefan expected to find a happily mending little girl, but he was unprepared for Emmy's condition. She was positively glowing. Only 2 weeks ago, according to Brendan, she had been crippled and dying. But now her dark eyes were clear, and her former pallor was gone, replaced by a wholesome flush. Her knuckles and wrists were not swollen, and she seemed to be completely free of pain. She looked not like a sick child valiantly fighting her way back to health. Rather, she seemed already cured. Most startling of all, Emmy was not lying in bed, but standing with the aid of crutches, moving among her delighted and admiring relatives. Her wheelchair was gone. "Well," Stefan said after a brief visit, "I must be going, Emmy. I only stopped by to wish you a Merry Christmas from a friend of yours, Brendan Cronin."
"Pudge," she said happily. "He's wonderful, isn't he? It was awful when he stopped working here. We miss him a lot."
Emmy's mother said, "I never met this Pudge, but from the way the kids talked about him, he must have been good medicine for them."
"He only worked here 1 week," Emmy said. "But he comes back, did you know? Every few days he comes back to visit. I was hoping he'd come today, so I could give him a big Christmas kiss."
"He wanted to stop by, but he's spending Christmas with his folks."
"Oh, that's good. That's what Christmas is for, isn't it, Father? Being together with your folks, having fun and loving each other?"
"Yes, Emmy," Stefan Bikazic said, thinking that no theologian or philosopher could have put it better. "That's what Christmas is for." If Stefan had been alone with the girl, he would have asked her about the afternoon of December 11th. That was the day Brendan had been brushing her hair while she sat in her wheelchair before this very window. Stefan wanted to know about the rings on Brendan's hands, which had appeared for the first time that day, and which Emmeline had noticed before Brendan himself spotted them. He wanted to ask Emmy if she had felt anything unusual when Brendan had touched her. But there were too many adults around, and they would surely ask awkward questions. Stefan was not yet prepared to reveal the reasons for his curiosity. Las Vegas, Nevada. After getting off to a rocky start, Christmas at the Monotella apartment improved dramatically. Mary and Pete stopped hammering Georgia with their well-meant but unwanted advice and criticism. They loosened up and involved themselves in Marcy's play the way grandparents should, and Georgia was reminded of just why she loved them so much. The holiday dinner was on the table at 12:50, only 20 minutes late, and it was delicious. By the time Marcy sat down to eat, she had worked off her all-consuming interest in Little Miss Doctor, and she did not rush through her meal. It was a leisurely dinner with much chit-chat and laughter, the Christmas tree twinkling in the background. Those were golden hours until, during dessert, the trouble started with surprising suddenness. With frightening speed, it escalated to total disaster. Teasing Marcy, Pete said,
"Where does a little bitty thing like you put so much food? You've eaten more than the rest of us combined." "Oh, Grandpa."
"It's true. You've been really shoveling it in. One more bite of that pumpkin pie and you're going to explode."
Marcy lifted another forkful, held it up for all to see, and with great theatricality she moved it toward her mouth.
"No, don't,"
Pete said, putting his hands in front of his face as if to protect himself from the blast. Marcy popped the morsel into her mouth, chewed and swallowed.
"See, I didn't explode."
"You will with the next bite," Pete said. "I was just one bite too soon. You'll explode, or else we'll have to rush you to the hospital."
Marcy frowned.
"No hospital."
"Oh, yes," Pete said. "You'll be all swollen up, ready to burst, and we'll have to rush you to the hospital and have them deflate you."
"No hospital,"
Marcy repeated adamantly. Georgia realized that her daughter's voice had changed, that the girl was no longer participating in the game, but was instead genuinely, if inexplicably, frightened. She was not scared of exploding, of course. but evidently the mere thought of a hospital had caused her to go pale.
"No hospital,"
Marcy repeated, a haunted look in her eyes.
"Oh, yes,"
Pete said, not yet aware of the change in the child. Georgia tried to deflect him.
"Dad, I think we..."
But Pete said,
"Of course they won't take you in an ambulance, 'cause you'll be too big. We'll have to rent a truck to haul you."
The girl shook her head violently.
"I won't go to a hospital in a million years. I won't ever let those doctors touch me."
"Honey," Georgia said, "Grandpa's only teasing. He doesn't really..."
Unplacated, the girl said,
"Those hospital people will hurt me like they hurt me before. I won't let them hurt me again."
Mary looked at Georgia, baffled.
When was she in the hospital?
"She wasn't,"
Georgia said.
"I don't know why she..."
I was! They tied me down in bed, stuffed me full of needles, and I was scared, and I won't ever let them touch me again."
Remembering the strange tantrum that Kara Persagian had reported yesterday, Georgia moved swiftly to forestall a similar scene. She put one hand on Marcy's shoulder and said,
"Honey, you were never..."
"I was!"
The girl's anger and fear burgeoned into rage and terror. She threw her fork, and Pete ducked to avoid being hit by it.
"Marcy!"
Georgia cried. The girl slipped off her chair and backed away from the table, white-faced.
"I'm going to grow up and be my own doctor, so nobody else will stick needles in me."
Words gave way to a pitiful moaning. Georgia went after Marcy, reaching for her.
"Honey, don't."
Marcy held her hands out in front of her, as if warding off an attack, although it was not her mother that she feared. She was looking through Georgia, perhaps seeing some imaginary threat, though her terror was real. She was not merely pale but translucent, as if the very substance of her was evaporating in the tremendous heat of her terror.
"Marcy, what is it?"
The girl stumbled backward into a corner, shuddering. Georgia gripped her daughter's defensively raised hands.
"Marcy, talk to me."
But even as Georgia spoke, a sudden stench of urine filled the air, and she saw a dark stain spreading from the crotch down both legs of Marcy's jeans.
"Marcy!"
The girl was trying to scream but could not.
"What's happening?" Mary asked. "What's wrong?"
"I don't know,"
Georgia said.
"God help me, I don't know."
With her eyes still focused on some figure or object that remained visible only to her, Marcy began a wordless keening. New York, New York. The tape deck still played Christmas music, and Jenny Twist lay immobile and insensate. But Jack no longer engaged in the frustrating one-way communication with which he had filled the first few hours of his visit. Now he sat in silence, and inevitably his thoughts drifted back through the years to his homecoming from Central America. Upon returning to the States, he had discovered that the rescue of the prisoners at the Institute of Brotherhood had been misrepresented in some quarters as a terrorist act, a mass kidnapping, a provocation meant to spark a war. He and every ranger involved were painted as criminals in uniform, and those taken prisoner were for some reason the special focus of the opposition's anger. In a political panic, Congress had banned all covert activities in Central America, including a pending plan to rescue the four rangers. Their release was to be arranged strictly through diplomatic channels. That was why they had waited in vain for rescue. Their country had abandoned them. At first Jack had trouble believing it. When at last he believed, it was the second worst shock of his life. Having won his freedom, home again, Jack was relentlessly pursued by hostile journalists and subpoenaed to appear before a congressional committee to testify about his involvement in the raid. He expected to have a chance to set the record straight, but he quickly discovered that they weren't interested in his viewpoint, and that the televised hearing was merely an opportunity for politicians to do some grandstanding in the infamous tradition of Joe McCarthy. In a few months, most people had forgotten him, and when he regained the pounds he had lost in prison, they ceased to recognize him as the alleged war criminal they had seen on television. But the pain and the sense of betrayal continued to burn fiercely in him. If being abandoned by his country was the second worst shock of his life, the worst was what had happened to Jenny while he had been stuck in that Central American prison. A thug had accosted her in the hallway of her own apartment building as she was coming home from work. He put a gun to her head, hustled her into her apartment, sodomized and raped her, clubbed her brutally with his pistol, and left her for dead. When Jack came home at last, he found Jenny in a state institution. Comatose. The level of care she had been getting was abominable. Norman Hazard, the rapist who attacked Jenny, had been tracked down through fingerprints and witnesses, but a clever defense attorney had managed to delay the trial. Undertaking an investigation of his own, Jack satisfied himself that Hazard, with a history of violent sex offenses, was the guilty man. He also became convinced that Hazard would be acquitted on a technicality. Throughout his ordeal with the press and politicians, Jack made plans for the future. There were two primary tasks ahead of him. First, he would kill Norman Hazard in such a way as to avoid any suspicion falling upon himself. Second, he would get enough money to move Jenny to a private sanitarium, though the only way to obtain so much cash in a hurry was to steal it. As an elite ranger, he was trained in most weapons, explosives, martial arts, and survival techniques. His society had failed him, but it had also provided him with the knowledge and the means by which he could extract his revenge, and it had taught him how to break whatever laws stood in his way without punishment. Norman Hazard died in an accidental gas explosion 2 months after Jack returned to the States, and 2 weeks later, Jenny's transference to a private sanitarium was financed by the proceeds from an ingenious bank robbery executed with military precision. The murder of Hazard did not satisfy Jack. In fact, it depressed him. Killing in a war was different from killing in civilian life. He did not have the detachment to kill except in self-defense. Robbery, however, was enormously appealing. After the successful bank job, he'd been excited, exalted, exhilarated. Daring robbery had a medicinal quality. Crime gave him a reason to live. Until recently. Now, sitting at Jenny's bedside, Jack Twist wondered what would keep him going day after day, if not grand larceny. The only other thing he had was Jenny. However, he no longer needed to provide for her. He had already piled up more than enough money for that, so his only reason for living was to come here several times a week, look upon her serene face, hold her hand, and pray for a miracle. It was ironic that a man like him, a hard-headed, self-reliant individualist, should have no hope but mysticism. As he brooded on that, he heard Jenny make a soft, gurgling sound. She took two quick, deep breaths and produced a long, rattling sigh. For one crazy moment as he rose from his chair, Jack half expected to find her eyes open, filled with awareness for the first time in more than 8 years, the miracle having come to pass even as he had been daydreaming of it. But her eyes were closed, and her face was slack. He put a hand against her face, then moved it to her throat. He felt for her pulse. What had happened was not, in fact, miraculous, but anti-miraculous, mundane, and inevitable. Jenny Twist had died. Chicago, Illinois. Few physicians were on duty at St. Joseph's that Christmas, but a resident named Jarvel and an intern named Clannett were eager to talk to Father Vikazic about Emmeline Hallberg's amazing recovery. Clannett, an intense, wiry-haired young man escorted Stefan to a consultation room to review Emmy's file and x-rays.
5 weeks ago, she was started on naloxone, a new drug just approved by the FDA.
Dr. Jarville, the resident, was soft-spoken with heavy-lidded eyes, but when he joined them in the consultation room, he too was visibly excited by Emmeline Hallberg's dramatic turn for the better.
Naloxone has several effects in bone diseases like Emmy's, Jarville said. In many instances, it puts a stop to the destruction of the periosteum, promotes the growth of healthy osteocytes, and somewhat induces the accumulation of intercellular calcium. And in a case like Emmy's, where the bone marrow is the primary target of the disease, naloxone creates an unusual chemical environment in the marrow cavity and in the eversion canals, an environment that's extremely hostile to microorganisms but actually encourages the growth of marrow cells, the production of blood cells, and hemoglobin formation.
But it's not supposed to work this fast, Kleinert said.
And it's basically a stop-loss drug, Jarville said. It can arrest the progress of a disease, put a stop to bone deterioration, but it doesn't make regeneration possible. Sure, it's supposed to promote some reconstruction, but not the kind of rebuilding we're seeing in Emmy.
Fast rebuilding, Kleinert said, smacking his forehead with the heel of his hand, as if to knock this amazing fact into his unwilling brain.
They showed Stefan a series of x-rays taken over the past 6 weeks, in which the changes in Emmy's bones and joints were obvious. Kleinert said,
She had been on naloxone for 3 weeks without noticeable effect, and then suddenly, 2 weeks ago, her body not only went into a state of remission but began rebuilding damaged tissues.
The timing of the girl's turnaround coincided perfectly with the first appearance of the strange rings on Brendan Cronin's hands. However, Stefan Vikazic made no mention of that coincidence. Jarville produced more x-rays and tests that showed a remarkable improvement in the child's eversion canals, the elaborate network that carried small blood vessels and lymphatics throughout the bone for the purpose of maintenance and repair. Many of these had been clogged with a plaque-like substance that pinched off the vessels passing through them. In the past 2 weeks, however, the plaque almost disappeared, allowing the full circulation required for healing and regeneration.
No one even knew that naloxone could clean out the canals this way, Jarville said. No record of it. Oh, yes, minor unclogging, but only as a consequence of getting the disease itself under control. Nothing like this. Amazing.
If regeneration continues at this rate, Kleinert said, Emmy could be a normal, healthy girl in 3 months.
Really? Phenomenal, Jarville said. She could be well again.
They grinned at Father Vikazic, and he did not have the heart to suggest that neither their hard work nor the wonder drug was responsible for Emmeline Hallberg's cure. They were euphoric, so Stefan kept to himself the possibility that Emmy's cure had been affected by some power far more mysterious than modern medicine. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Christmas Day with Lucy, Frank, and the grandchildren was fun and therapeutic for Ernie and Faye Block. By the time they went out for a walk, just the two of them, toward the end of the afternoon, they were feeling better than they had in months. The weather was perfect for walking, cold, crisp, but without wind. The most recent snowfall was 4 days old, so the sidewalks were clear. As twilight approached, the air shimmered with a purple radiance. Bundled in heavy coats and scarves, Faye and Ernie strolled arm in arm, talking animatedly about the day's events, enjoying the Christmas displays that Lucy's and Frank's neighbors had erected on their front lawns. The years slipped away, and Faye felt as if she and Ernie were still newlyweds, young and full of dreams. From the moment they had arrived in Milwaukee on December 15th, 10 days ago, Faye had reason to hope that everything was going to work out all right. Ernie had seemed better, a new bounciness in his step, more genuine good humor in his smile. Evidently, just
basking in the love of his daughter, son-in-law, and grandchildren was sufficient to burn away some of the crippling fear that had become the central fact of his life. The therapy sessions with Dr. Fontelaine, six so far, had also been remarkably beneficial. Ernie was still afraid of the dark, but far less terrified than when they left Nevada. Phobias, according to the doctor, were easy to treat compared to many other psychiatric disorders. In recent years, therapists had discovered that in most cases, the symptoms were the disease, rather than merely shadows cast by unresolved conflicts in the patient's subconscious. It was no longer considered necessary, or even possible or desirable, to seek the psychological causes of the condition in order to treat it. Long courses of therapy had been abandoned in favor of teaching the patient desensitization techniques that could eradicate the symptoms in months, or even weeks. Approximately a third of all phobics could not be helped by these methods, and instead required long-term treatment, and even panic-blocking drugs like alprazolam. But Ernie had improved at a pace that even Dr. Fontelaine, an optimist by nature, found astonishing. Faye had been reading extensively about phobias, and had discovered she could help Ernie by digging up amusing, curious facts that allowed him to view his condition from a different, less fearsome perspective. He was especially fond of hearing about bizarre phobias that made his terror of the dark seem reasonable by comparison. For example, knowing there were pteranophobics out there, people who lived in constant and unreasonable fear of feathers, made his abhorrence of nightfall seem not only bearable but almost ordinary and logical as well. Ichthyophobes were horrified by the prospect of encountering a fish, and pediophobes ran screaming at the sight of a doll. And Ernie's nyctophobia was certainly preferable to coitophobia, the fear of sexual intercourse, and not a fraction as debilitating as autophobia, the fear of oneself. Now, walking through the twilight, Faye tried to keep Ernie's mind off the descending darkness by telling him about the late author, John Cheever, winner of the National Book Award, who had been gepherophobic. Cheever had suffered from a crippling fear of crossing high bridges. Ernie listened with fascination, but he was no less aware of the onset of nightfall. As the shadows lengthened across the snow, his hand steadily tightened on her arm until it would have been painful if she had not been wearing a thick sweater and heavy coat. By the time they had gone seven blocks, they were too far from the house to have any hope of returning to it before full darkness settled on the land. Two-thirds of the sky was black already, and the other third was deep purple. The shadows had spread like spilt ink. The street lamps had come on. Faye halted Ernie in a cone of light, giving him a brief reprieve. His eyes had a wild look, and his steaming exhalations rushed from him at a rate that indicated incipient panic.
"Remember to control your breathing," Faye said.
He nodded and began at once to take deeper, slower breaths. When all the light in the sky had been extinguished, she said,
"Ready to go back?"
"Ready," he said hollowly. They stepped out of the glow of the street lamp into darkness, heading back toward the house, and Ernie hissed between clenched teeth. What they were engaged upon, for the third time, was a dramatic therapeutic technique called flooding, in which the phobic was encouraged to confront the thing he feared, and to endure it long enough to break its hold on him. Flooding is based on the fact that panic attacks are self-limiting. The human body cannot sustain a very high level of panic indefinitely, cannot produce endless adrenaline, so the mind must adapt to and make peace, or at least a truce, with what it fears. Unmodified flooding can be a cruel, barbaric method of cracking a phobia, for it puts the patient at risk of a breakdown. Dr. Fontelaine preferred a modified version of the technique involving three stages of confrontation with the source of fear. The first stage, in Ernie's case, was to put himself in darkness for 15 minutes. But with Faye at his side for support
and with lighted areas easily accessible. Now, each time they arrived at the lighted sidewalk beneath a street lamp, they paused to let him gather his courage, then went on into the next patch of darkness. The second stage, which they would try in another week or two after more sessions with the doctor, would involve driving to a place where there were no street lamps, no easily reached lighted areas. There they would walk together arm in arm across an unrelieved vista of darkness until Ernie could tolerate no more, at which time Faye would switch on a flashlight and give him a moment's respite. In the third stage of treatment, Ernie would go for a stroll alone in a completely dark area. After a few outings like that, he would almost certainly be cured. But he was not cured yet, and by the time they covered 6 blocks of the 7-block return journey to the house, Ernie was breathing like a well-run racehorse, and he bolted for the safety of the light inside. Not bad, though. 6 blocks. Better than before. At this rate, he would be cured in no time. As Faye followed him into the house, where Lucy was already helping him out of his coat, she tried to feel good about his progress to date. If this pace held, he would complete the third and final stage weeks, maybe even a couple of months ahead of schedule. That was what worried Faye. His rapid improvement was amazing. It seemed too rapid and too amazing to be real. She wanted to believe the nightmare would be put behind them quickly, but the pace of his recuperation made her wonder if it was lasting. Striving always to think positive, Faye Block was nevertheless plagued by the instinctive and unnerving feeling that something was wrong. Very wrong. Boston, Massachusetts. Inevitably, given his exotic background as a godson of Picasso and a once-famous European stage performer, Pablo Jackson was a star in Boston social circles. Furthermore, during World War II, he had been a liaison between British intelligence and the French resistance forces, and his recent work as a hypnotist with police agencies had only added to his mystique. He never lacked invitations. On the evening of Christmas Day, Pablo attended a black-tie dinner party for 22 at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Ira Hergensheimer in Brooklyn. The house was a splendid brick Georgian colonial, as elegant and warmly welcoming as the Hergensheimers themselves, who had made their money in real estate during the 1950s. A bartender was on duty in the library, and white-jacketed waiters circulated through the enormous drawing room with champagne and canapés, and in the foyer, a string quartet played just loudly enough to provide pleasant background music. Among that engaging company, the man of most interest to Pablo was Alexander Christofsen, former ambassador to the Court of St. James, one-term United States Senator from Massachusetts, later director of the Central Intelligence Agency, now retired almost a decade, whom Pablo had known half a century. Now 76, Christofsen was the second eldest guest, but old age had been nearly as kind to him as to Pablo. He was tall, distinguished, with remarkably few lines in his classic Bostonian face. His mind was as sharp as ever. The true length of his journey on the earth was betrayed only by a mild trace of Parkinson's disease, which, in spite of medication, left him with a tremor in his right hand. Half an hour before dinner, Pablo eased Alex away from the other guests and led him to Ira Hergensheimer's oak-paneled study, adjacent to the library, for a private conversation. The old magician closed the door behind them, and they carried their glasses of champagne to a pair of leather wing-back chairs by the window. "Alex, I need your advice."
"Well, as you know," Alex said, "men our age find it especially satisfying to give advice. It compensates for no longer being able to set a bad example ourselves. I can't imagine what advice I could give on any problem that you wouldn't already have thought of yourself."
"Yesterday," Pablo said, "a young woman came to see me. She's an exceedingly lovely,
charming and intelligent woman who's accustomed to solving her own problems. But now she's bumped up against something very strange. She desperately needs help. Alex raised his eyebrows.
Beautiful young women still come to you for help at 81. I am impressed, humbled, and envious, Pablo.
This is not a coup de foudre, you filthy-minded old lizard. Passion isn't involved. Without mentioning Ginger Weiss's name or occupation, Pablo discussed her problem, the bizarre and inexplicable fugues, and recounted a session of hypnotic regression that had ended with her frightening withdrawal. She actually seemed about to retreat into a deep, self-induced coma, perhaps even into death to avoid my questions. Naturally, I refused to put her in a trance again and risk another withdrawal of that severity. But I promised to do some research to see if any similar case was on record. I found myself poring through books most of last evening and this morning, searching for references to memory blocks with self-destruction built into them. At last, I found it in one of your books. Of course, you were writing about an imposed psychological condition as a result of brainwashing, and this woman's block is of her own creation. But the similarity is there. Drawing on his experiences in the intelligence services during World War II and the subsequent Cold War, Alex Christofsson had written several books, including two that dealt with brainwashing. In one, Alex had described a technique he called the Azrael Block, naming it for one of the angels of death, that seemed uncannily like the barrier that surrounded Ginger Weiss's memory of some traumatic event in her past. As distant string music came to them, muffled by the closed study door, Alex put down his champagne glass because his hands trembled too violently. He said,
"I don't suppose you'd drop this matter and forget all about it, because I'm telling you that's the wisest course."
"Well," Pablo said, a bit surprised by the ominous tone of his friend's voice, "I've promised her I'll try to help."
"I've been retired 8 years, and my instincts aren't what they once were, but I have a very bad feeling about this."
"Drop it, Pablo. Don't see her again. Don't try to help her any more."
"But, Alex, I've promised her."
"I was afraid that'd be your position."
Alex folded his tremulous hands.
"Okay, the Azrael Block. It's not something that Western intelligence services use often, but the Soviets find it invaluable. For example, let's imagine a top-notch Russian agent named Ivan, an operative with 30 years' service in the KGB. In Ivan's memory, there'll be an incredible amount of highly sensitive information that, were it to fall into Western hands, would devastate Russian espionage networks. Ivan's superiors constantly worry that on some foreign assignment he'll be identified and interrogated.
As I understand it, with current drugs and hypnotic techniques, no one can withhold information from a determined interrogator."
"Exactly. No matter how tough he is, Ivan will spill all he knows without being tortured. For that reason, his superiors would prefer to send younger agents who, if caught, would have less valuable information to reveal. But many situations require a seasoned man like Ivan, so the possibility of all his knowledge falling into enemy hands is a nightmare with which his superiors must live, whether they like it or not."
"The risk of doing business."
"Exactly. However, let's imagine that among all the sensitive knowledge in his head, Ivan knows two or three things that are especially sensitive, so explosive that their revelation could destroy his country. These particular memories, less than 1% of his knowledge about KGB operations, could be suppressed without affecting his performance in the field. We're talking here about the suppression of a very tiny portion of his memories.
Then, if he fell into enemy hands, he'd still give up a great deal of valuable stuff during interrogation, but at least he would not be able to reveal those few most crucial memories.
And this is where the Azrael block comes in, Pablo said. Ivan's own people use drugs and hypnosis to seal off certain parts of his past before sending him overseas on his next assignment.
Alex nodded. For example, say that years ago, Ivan was one of the agents involved in the attempted assassination of Pope John Paul II. With a memory block in place, his awareness of that involvement could be locked in his subconscious, beyond the reach of potential interrogators, without affecting his work on new assignments. But not just any block will do. If Ivan's interrogators discover a standard memory block, they'll work diligently to unlock it, because they'll know that what lies behind it is of enormous importance. So the barrier must be one that cannot be tampered with. The Azrael block is perfect. When the subject is questioned about the forbidden topic, he's programmed to retreat into a deep coma where he cannot hear the Inquisitioner's voice, and even into death. In fact, it should more accurately be called the Azrael trigger, because if the interrogator probes into the blocked memories, he pulls that trigger, shooting Ivan into a coma, and if he continues to pull the trigger, he may eventually kill the subject.
Fascinated, Pablo said, but isn't the survival instinct strong enough to overcome the block? When it comes to the point that Ivan must either remember and reveal what he has forgotten, or die, well, surely the repressed memory would surface.
No. Even in the warm amber light of the floor lamp beside his chair, Alex's face appeared to have gone gray. Not with the drugs and hypnotic techniques we have these days. Mind control is a frighteningly advanced science. The survival instinct is the strongest we've got, but even that can be overridden. Ivan can be programmed to self-destruct.
Pablo found his champagne glass empty. My young lady friend seems to have invented a sort of Azrael block of her own to hide from herself some extraordinarily distressing event in her past.
No, Alex said. She didn't farm the block herself.
She must have. She's in a bad state, Alex. She just slips away when I try to question her. So, as you know this field, I thought you might have a few ideas about how I can deal with it.
You still don't understand why I warned you to drop this whole thing, Alex said.
He pushed up from his chair, moved to the nearby window, shoved his trembling hands in his pockets, and stared out at the snow-covered lawn.
A self-imposed, naturally generated Azrael block? Such a thing is impossible. The human mind will not, of its own volition, put itself at risk of death merely to conceal something from itself. An Azrael block is always an externally applied control. If you've encountered such a barrier, then someone planted it in her mind.
You're saying she's been brainwashed? Ridiculous. She's no spy.
I'm sure she's not.
She's no Russian. So why would she have been brainwashed? Ordinary citizens don't become targets for that sort of thing.
Alex turned from the window and faced Pablo. This is just an educated guess, but perhaps she accidentally saw something she was not supposed to see. Something extremely important, secret. Subsequently, she was subjected to a sophisticated process of memory repression to make sure she never told anyone about it. Pablo stared at him, astonished.
But what could she possibly have seen to have made such extreme measures necessary?
Alex shrugged.
And who could have tampered with her mind?
Alex said, The Russians? The CIA? The Israeli Mossad, Britain's M16, any organization with the knowledge of how such things are done.
I don't think she's traveled outside the U.S., which leaves the CIA.
Not necessarily. All the others operate in this country for their own purposes. Besides, intelligence organizations are not the only groups who are familiar with mind control techniques. So are some crackpot religious cults, fanatical political fringe groups, others. Knowledge spreads fast, and evil knowledge spreads faster. If people like that want her to forget something, you sure don't want to help her remember. It wouldn't be healthy for either you or her, Pablo.
I can't believe.
Believe, Alex said somberly.
But these fumes, these sudden fears of black gloves and helmets, these would seem to indicate that her memory block is cracking. Yet the people you've mentioned wouldn't have done a half-baked job, would they? If they had implanted a block, it would be perfect.
Alex returned to his chair, sat, leaned forward, fixing Pablo with an intense gaze, obviously striving to impress him with the gravity of the situation.
That's what worries me most, old friend. Ordinarily, such a firmly implanted mental barrier would never weaken on its own. The people capable of doing this to your lady friend are absolutely expert at it. They wouldn't screw up. So her recent problems, her deteriorating psychological condition, can mean only one thing.
Yes?
The forbidden memories, the secrets buried behind this Azrael block, are apparently so explosive, so frightening, so traumatic, that not even an expertly engineered barrier can contain them. Buried in this woman is a shocking memory of immense power, and it's straining to break out of its prison in her subconscious into her conscious mind. These objects that trigger her blackouts, the gloves, the sink drain, are very like the elements of those repressed memories. When she fixates on one of these things, she's close to a breakthrough, trembling on the edge of remembrance. Then her program kicks in and she blocks out.
Pablo's heart quickened with excitement.
Then, after all, it might be possible to use hypnotic regression to probe at this Azrael block, widen the cracks already in it without driving her into a coma. One would have to be extremely cautious, of course, but with...
You're not listening to me,
Alex said, bolting up again. He stood between their chairs, looming over Pablo, pointing one trembling finger at him.
This is incredibly dangerous. You've stumbled into something much too big for you to handle. If you help her to remember, you're going to make powerful enemies somewhere.
She's a sweet girl, and her life is in ruins because of this.
You can't help her. You're too old, and you're just one man.
Listen, maybe you don't understand enough of the situation. I haven't told you her name or profession, but I'll tell you now that...
I don't want to know who she is,
Alex said, his eyes widening. She's a physician, Pablo persisted.
Or almost. She's spent the past 14 years training herself for medical practice, and now she's losing everything.
It's tragic.
Think about this, damn it. She's almost certain to discover that knowing the truth is even worse than not knowing. If the repressed memories are breaking through like this, then they must be so traumatic that they could destroy her psychologically.
Maybe, Pablo acknowledged. But shouldn't she be the one to decide whether or not to keep digging for the truth?
Alex was adamant.
If the memory itself doesn't destroy her, then she'll probably be killed by whoever implanted the block. I'm surprised they didn't kill her straight away. If it is an intelligence agency behind us, ours or theirs, then you've got to remember that to them civilians are entirely expendable. She got a rare and amazing reprieve when they used brainwashing instead of a bullet. A bullet's quicker and cheaper. They won't give her a second reprieve. If they discover that the Azrael block has crumbled, if they learn that she's uncovered the secret they've hidden from her, they'll blow her brains out.
You can't be sure, Pablo said. Besides, she's a real go-getter, Alex, an achiever, a mover and shaker, so from her point of view, her current situation is almost as bad as having her brains blown out.
Making no effort to conceal his frustration with the old magician, Alex said,
"You help her, and they'll blow your brains out as well.
Doesn't that give you pause?"
At 81, Pablo said, "not much of interest happens. You can't afford to turn your back on that rare bit of excitement when it comes along.
Vogue la galère.
I must chance it."
"You're making a mistake."
"Maybe I am, my friend. Maybe. But then why do I feel so good?"
Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Bennett Sonneford, who had operated on Winton Tolk yesterday, subsequent to the shooting at the sandwich shop, ushered Father Vikazik into a spacious den where the walls were covered with mounted fish. Marlin, an immense albacore, bass, trout. More than 30 glass eyes stared sightlessly down upon the two men. A trophy case was filled with silver and gold cups, bowls, medallions. The doctor sat at a pine desk in the shadow of a forever-swimming, open-mouthed marlin of startling proportions, and Stefan sat beside the desk in a comfortable chair. Although the hospital had provided only Dr. Sonnefer's office number, Father Vikazik had been able to track down the surgeon's home address with the aid of friends at the telephone company and police department. He had arrived at Sonneford's doorstep at 7:30 Christmas night, effusively apologetic about interrupting holiday celebrations. "Now," Stefan said, "Brendan works with me at St. Bernadette's, and I think very highly of him, so I don't want to see him in trouble." Sonneford, who looked a bit like a fish, pale, slightly protuberant eyes, a naturally puckered mouth, said,
"Trouble?"
He opened a kit of small tools, choosing a miniature screwdriver, and turned his attention to a fly-casting reel that lay on the blotter.
"What trouble?"
"Interfering with officers in the performance of their duties."
"Pshh, ridiculous." Sonneford carefully removed tiny screws from the reel housing. "If he had intended to talk, the man would be dead now. We gave him 4.5 liters.
"Really? That isn't a mistake on the patient's chart?"
"No mistake."
Sonneford removed the metal case from the automatic reel, peered intently into its mechanical guts.
"An adult has 70 milliliters of blood per kilogram of body weight. Tolk is a big man, 100 kilos. He'd normally contain 7 liters. So when I first ordered blood,